In taping these lectures by Father John Hardin, S.J., on the principles and practice of formation in the religious life, it has been necessary from time to time to retape or re-record because of excessive tape or surface noise. The substitute voice is Robert Warnock, but the ideas, the words, the conclusions are all Father John Hardin, S.J. But we are now at a new section in this series of lectures. We are at number 16. The general title, Human Respect in the Religious Life. We will look at this under three aspects. By now you know I feel guilty if I can't divide what I'm saying into three. My model for that is St. Ignatius. His great devotion to the Trinity made him divide everything into threes. Part one, what is human respect? Second, why is it important to overcome in the religious life? And third, how to train those in formation to cope with religious life. First, then, what is human respect? Isn't it remarkable? The things that have plagued us from childhood, we may go through life and have never bothered defining. This is one man's definition. Out of curiosity, I looked up to see whether I had it in the modern Catholic dictionary. I was embarrassed. It wasn't there. I hope I wasn't guilty of human respect in not putting it in. What is human respect? Human respect is a failing in the spiritual life, period. As such, it is the fear of rejection or of non-acceptance of others. It is the fear of rejection or non-acceptance by others. Human respect easily leads a person into sin or prevents a person from doing something morally good. So human respect is a failing in the spiritual life. As a failing, it is the fear of rejection or non-acceptance by others, period. It either leads a person into sin or at least prevents someone from doing something which they know they should be doing, which is morally good. Why? Out of human respect. In essence, I'm still on definition, but I want to define it even more closely. In essence, human respect is a combination of pride and cowardice. It is a combination of pride and cowardice, often disguised as humility or prudence. Having defined human respect, we now ask, why is it significant to deal with human respect in the religious life? Sure enough, I have three reasons. Why is it significant? First, because we all have a strong desire for acceptance by others. We all naturally want to be accepted by others. And the most fundamental form of acceptance we want by others is to have them think well of us. We're not even so concerned what they say about us. We want to make sure that they think nice about us. Now, why is it especially critical in the religious life? Because in a religious community, we have no alternative except the other members of the community. We can't roam around looking for other people to think well of us. We might say, well, we are cut. We are limited in the number of people whom we want to think well of us, namely those with whom we live. One reason that some people find so much time and enjoyment outside the community is because they don't find the acceptance in the community. And the hunger for acceptance, some psychologists say, is the deepest in human nature. It is the desire for social survival. Just to have people around us is not to be living in a society. The people must accept one another. Otherwise, you don't even have the foundations of a society. First reason why human respect is so significant in religious life. Because outside the community, we don't, or we shouldn't, have viable alternatives. The most important kind of person by whom we wish to be accepted are, or should be, our own fellow religious. And they better provide that acceptance. Otherwise, Lord, help that community. Second reason, not everyone with a religious vocation is equally generous with God, needless to say. Some people who enter religious life are more generous, others less. Now, suppose I am more generous with God. Call me A. Someone else who is less generous with God, call that person B. A wants to be accepted by B. B wants to be accepted by A. But common sense tells A, I'm going to find it harder to be accepted by B because B seems not to be as generous with God as I am. So, if nothing else, she will envy me. And B might fear not being accepted by A because A, if he or she is more generous, will give evidence of that generosity and B will feel inferior. In 30 years, we never say one word to anybody. The most important things in our lives, we never tell anyone, except, I hope, God. You see, the formula for non-acceptance of A by B and B by A, given the fact that no two people are equally generous with God. Now, that generosity may be, and let's say that it is, mainly the result of having received different graces. One has more grace to be more generous. Someone has said, and how true it is, there is only one way of avoiding envy so people won't envy you. Be a failure. No one envies a failure. The price of success is envy. And where one person envies another, there is not acceptance. That is fertile ground for human respect. So A, who is more generous with God, will be tempted to be less generous because she wants to be accepted by B. Let me make sure. Am I clear? The price of acceptance by a human being is, or can be, even rejection of God. The most tragic historic instance in Revelation is Adam's failure in human respect with respect to his wife Eve. He wanted to be accepted by Eve, who, when he realized what she had done, he realized also she had disobeyed Yahweh. To keep Eve, Adam was willing to reject God. Third reason why human respect is such a critical element of the spiritual life. Well, there are powerful sanctions that a religious fears, either from our own fellow religious or from the community at large or from the superiors. Now, let me explain and further comment. In any society, there are powerful sanctions, and by sanctions I mean threats, that hover over the members of a society. In the church, we call that excommunication. If you're a member of a society, you want to be accepted by that society, and every society has its own sanctions. First of all, there are the fears that a religious has from his or her own fellow religious. As simple but painful a thing as silence or coldness. And for some people, it can be a terrible pain not to have someone that I love apparently not loving me. Well, because she's not talking to me. And don't tell me, I've been in community life for too many years. But don't tell me that these sanctions are not used by one religious on another. In fact, a good examination of conscience that every religious can make each day is, what sanctions I've used on my fellow religious to show my displeasure or anger or irritation or disappointment. Now, there are situations where I have a right to express my disapproval. Many other situations, I have no right to show that I do not accept, I do not like, I reject what that person has said or done, and in effect, the person, him or herself. There are the sanctions from the community itself. If you have not read, may I ask all of you and all who will read or hear this recording, to read in the, I think it is the January issue, January 1982, of the Homiletic and Pastoral Review on the plight of the papist priest, the trials through which faithful priests in our country have to go as a price of their fidelity, especially to the Holy Father. They are farmed out into small, undesirable country parishes. They are not given positions in the diocese to which, by talent and experience, they may have a right. So, in a community, there are many ways that a community can reject one of its members. Someone should write a volume on rejection by a religious community and the fear of such rejection. So a religious who has been trying to live a good religious life but is called in, as one was called in, I'm sure I've mentioned this in some previous conference, shortly before her final vows by the then Mother General and being told, "Now, sister, you are being approved for your final vows, but on one condition. The condition is on this paper. Read it." The document said, "I, the undersigned, promise, after I have made my last vows, never again to wear the religious habit." That's the sanction that a religious fears out of human respect. Am I still clear? Only God knows the number of women religious who have removed their religious garb out of human respect or fear of rejection by the community. And I mean rejection. Or finally, rejection by the superior. This is where those in authority in a community have a grave responsibility to be careful on how they act and react, sometimes to the pathetic weakness foibles of those under their charge. Our sensitivity, or should I say hypersensitivity, to their weaknesses or failures may cause them to do or not do things which conscience tells them they should or should not do to please you. And which superior in his or her right mind would say that he or she is a perfect example of how a religious should behave? We are all weak, fallen human beings. So much for why treatment of human respect is important in the religious life. Third, how to train those in formation not to overcome this human respect, but how to deal with it. How not to allow human respect to master our lives. First, here I have not three, but 10. Which is also a good biblical number. First, help those under your charge to develop their humility. If the bedrock of dealing with the demon of human respect is humility, and clearly a proud person will constantly fail in giving in to human respect, or fail in standing up to being rejected or not being accepted, because both acceptance and the fear of rejection by human beings is a form of pride. And here I would say, teach them, oh, teach them to learn from their humiliations. The good God is constantly humiliating us, and that is not an exaggerated adverb. Constantly. Both interiorly and exteriorly, in order to make us humble. Accept the Son of God and His all-blessed Mother. The royal road to humility is humiliation. Second, teach those under your care the necessity of courage. Courage in the Christian vocabulary is not mainly the fortitude or the daring to start something. The principal meaning of courage in Christianity is the strength to endure something. Teach them life is filled with people who will not ever fully accept us. Help them to resign themselves not to be living in a dream world of thinking they've got to please everybody. A homemade axiom that I would like to recommend on this: anyone who tries to please everyone ends by pleasing no one. Anyone who tries to please everyone ends by pleasing no one. It takes years to learn this. Some never do. This is where we have to draw on our faith. Number one, we had declared it was necessary to develop your humility. And number two, to teach the necessity of courage. And we were on number three, without judging others' motives, realize that not a few will not be as faithful as they should be. In other words, we cannot help but to judge people's conduct. Not to do so would be to abdicate our reason. What we are not to do is judge people's motives, which only God can clearly understand. The value of this in coping with human respect is that I may judge a person to be worse than he or she is by their conduct, when, as a matter of fact, the person may be doing whatever they are doing from, if not a very good motive, at least not as simple a motive as I may suspect. And this would protect me from wanting to reform that person by judging the action to be worse than the person, worse than that person really is. Number four, are there any singularities in the personality which must always be balanced with the idea of being willing to stand up to one's own convictions, no matter who does what? You know, there is a very subtle byplay between standing up to what I think that God wants me to do and being proud and taking credit for the standing up, for the being different. One should be willing to be different if God's will demands it, but one should avoid being singular, thus to call it vanity or pride. Number five, make sure that what you are doing is according to rule, and if necessary, approved by the superior and or the confessor. In this way, if we happen to be singular, because others are not doing what they should be doing, this singularity will not feed your vanity. In fact, it may be humiliating to be different than someone else. We tend to want to be different by the species of pride. But be sure if we are different, it's because we are obedient, and others perhaps are less obedient or less faithful to what they should be doing. Number six, realize that God's grace is different for different people. Now, this is a hard directive of the religious life. On the one hand, you are not to be singular, not to want to be different, to conform to the rule. And on the other hand, you must recognize the grace that God gives me cannot be precisely the same grace that God gives someone else. We are different personalities, not only by nature, but by grace. And the essence of person and personality is individuality. God treats each one of us as individuals. Just to compare, St. Francis with the St. Ignatius. Francis, the model of simplicity. Ignatius, the model of supernatural strategy. Or Francis Cabrini, compared with a little flower. Mother Cabrini, worldly wise, practical, traveling between Europe and the United States many times. You might say a worldly wise saint. The little flower, a cloistered contemplative. There are talents and graces in every woman's community, Cabrini's and the little flowers, and they are different. Be sure that you are faithful to your grace and not be a victim of human respect in feeling to be different, because God is dealing with you as a distinct supernatural person. Number seven, never be afraid to be different, provided you are sure it is God's will. And that's why obedience is so important in controlling human respect. When I was studying philosophy, we had a rule which went back centuries, wherein we were never to talk in English except during periods of recreation. We were to talk only in Latin. You can imagine the wall of silence that would come over the community if only everybody were faithful to that rule of talking in Latin outside the periods of recreation. I found out most of our fellow scholastics were not talking Latin. I said to myself, I didn't enter the religious life to conform to other people. I became a religious to conform to God's will. So I went to see the rector. I told him my predicament. What do I do? Well, he said, you keep talking Latin. Now, to help you, why don't you gather together a group of like-minded scholastics, gather them around you, tell them I told you, you are looking for scholastics who want to talk Latin outside times of recreation. And I give you permission, if you are in the company of those who insist on talking English, you talk English. But among your select few, you agree to talk Latin. I did that in my last year of philosophy and my 4 years of theology. What an experience. Before my ordination, not giving in to people out of human respect, and I protected myself by conferring with the rector. And I tell you, I would not give in. There would be a knock at the door, and in Latin, I would tell him to come in. He would open the door and laugh. What did you say? I continued to talk in Latin. Now look, we're in the United States. Would you please talk English? And I would answer him in Latin. My friends, you have to really control human respect, not to give in to what others are doing, especially when they are being disobedient to the rule. Number 8, if you decide that there are certain things that God wants you to do, keep doing them until you develop the habit. Then after a while, it will be easier to be faithful, because others will simply take you for granted. When I was ordained, I made a rule to never stand less than 30 minutes at the altar saying Mass. Whether other priests before me would be late, either in starting or in finishing, I was followed by another priest, but they could shoot me before I would spend less than 30 minutes at the altar. After a month or 6 weeks, they gave up. They just decided that's the way Hardin is. Am I making any sense? Human respect has got to be overcome. By developing the habit of doing what conscience tells you to do, and afterwards, people will simply take you for granted. Some people are tall. Some are short. Some eat a lot. Some eat little. Some are always smiling. Some are always frowning. And so you just happen to be different. Number 9. Remember that what other people are is really none of your business. You be what God wants you to be. And this is a very valuable piece of advice. The next time you are tempted to give in to human respect by conforming to other people's conduct against your own conscience, remember that other people are just as tempted to human respect as you are. Even as you have the urge to become like others, others have the urge to become like you. In other words, your behavior, according to conscience, can be a greater or lesser asset to your fellow religious. You can make it easier for them to live good religious lives. They have your example to encourage them, even if at first their bad example may have discouraged you. Now, number 10, and the last. How to train those in formation to cope with human respect in the religious life. The most effective way is to cultivate divine respect. Respect means looking at someone else and wanting to be like that one. In your case, the one who you know is watching you. Close, constant union with God. Live in God's presence and human beings will bother you less and less. I frankly believe that most victims of human respect are people who are not living recollected lives. They are so preoccupied with what people think of them, they forget to be concerned about what God thinks of them. With God on your mind, you will take people for granted. So much for human respect in the religious life.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.